Accession number 27753, Reel 3.
Stan?
Mr. Paul Cooper, Reel 3.
Yes, here's Paul Cooper again. Yeah. Yes, on the Queen Elizabeth, the 12-inch gun fitted. They said it was reinforced, but we're quite confident that it would blow the stern off the Queen Elizabeth if we ever had to fire. And the recoil, good stuff, would probably end up on the forecastle, which was, I suppose, a couple of hundred yards ahead. Yes, we hit a wave. Never had to use the gun, thank goodness, the 12-inch. And it we went through, right into the sea, which was gale blowing, and it actually smashed the 6-inch gun off the forecastle. Really, just buckled it up, could no further use to anyone, and also flooded the A and B deck, those wonderful curved bridge of the Queen Elizabeth. See how high. Or how deeply we went, and of course the Queen Elizabeth relied on speed and did the from Gunner to Gurlick, I think it was, to New York in 5 days. We relied on speed to I think go up round Iceland Way and speed round the big circle and into New York Harbour up the Hudson. And I remember it was all frozen over at that time, and we sailed on the 19th of January and arrived there 5 days later. And of course it was rather wonderful because on the Queen Elizabeth, whereas the bread was brown here all wartime, and the rations of course, was it 4 ounces of meat and 2 ounces of butter a week or that kind, and it was all heaps of chicken and heaps of steak and heaps of white bread, and you queued up and got as much as you wanted and go round again if you wanted. Absolutely wonderful. The great hall deck, ballroom if you like, the bunks were 24 high all over. It carried at that time to America, was able to carry about, I think it was something like 24,000 troops it could carry. Yes, of course we were not in that business. Mainly it was just people collecting different craft, even merchant craft and things. Anyway, we landed in New York with
landed in New York
and went straight to the Brooklyn Navy Yard and lived it up for quite a few weeks, and watching the ship being welded together, very thin metal. And remember the young people who were welding this craft, half flat bottom landing craft, infantry large, we learned, hadn't got a clue what we were about. And when they knew we were going to sail this back to the Atlantic, they were horrified, because they believed it never would make it.
It's flat bottom.
It's a half flat bottom. And of course, many of the craft were broken up sailing. We were only, there were only three of us left New York, Perth Amboy, only three of us. At that time, and we had engine trouble straight away and went into Bermuda, but I don't mind didn't mind at the time because it was wonderful, longing to go back there because there the flowers and the all the fauna and the butterflies and flowers and the coral were so marvelous that I intend to go back sometime.
How many were on the craft?
There were 22, okay. 22 crew.
And who was in charge?
Well, there was a lieutenant in charge.
Can you recall his name?
Yes, I can. I don't know whether I should. But his surname was Mowat.
Mowat?
Mowat, yeah.
How do you spell that?
M-O-A-R-T, titled. which shall, I think, perhaps better not mention, because I heard and wanted very much. I heard on the Channel 4 BBC one of the titled ones last year, and I thought, shall I contact? I'm sure he'd be dead, because he's older than I was anyway. Sure he'd be dead.
What was the name of your unit? Did you have a number or a...
Well, our craft is the important factor. LCIL, LCI brackets, L, Landing Craft Infantry Large. 240 troops we could carry land. And that was 114, the number. I have seen it in once in a war book. I've got a photograph somewhere in the surf, because no cameras were allowed anyway. That's that one of those on the buoy was wrong. It shouldn't be, but somebody had one.
But at that time, you were known as Combined Operations.
That's right, Combined Operations.
And did you have a number like your regiment number or your unit number?
Never used.
Right.
No, never used. Royal Navy Combined Operations.
Wow.
Yeah.
Police.
Oh yeah.
That's it.
Yes. So we waited till the craft was finished welding. As I said, the young people. The welding were horrified and were very generous to us, would give us whatever we wanted to get over the coldness, because it was about 14 degrees below there when we were there. Everything froze below deck. And I remember the hair tonics and things that people had were freezing, absolutely freezing on board. But we lived very well there, and they treated us very well indeed.
You stayed on board the Queen Elizabeth?
No, straight ashore,
right.
Straight ashore. And I remember some of the carelessness of the baggage handlers. Baggage was falling on the between the ship, and they were able to be retrieved because it was on the ice. Yeah, so it really was good. Anyway. We eventually collected, our ship was commissioned at Perth Amboy, and we sailed, having trouble, engine trouble. I don't know what caused it, but I suspect that the motor mechanics had failed to do something. And we went into Bermuda for about 6 weeks, and it was rather strange, because even that time in the war, they didn't want to replenish the ship with water. It was so scarce, and every roof possible was painted white so they could collect every drop of rainwater that they could. Yes, which is a point about sailing on such a ship. We were many times without fresh water, and we had diesel oil in the fresh water and salt water in the diesel oil. You know, with cracks appearing, really was quite a serious business. And as regards to, I remember we sent a message that we would have to proceed on our own, because we were in a convoy of 90 ships, 12 escort vessels, and they asked us to if we would go around the perimeter as well, being part of the convoy, guard, aircraft, American aircraft carrier in the middle of 90 ships, and the seas became so high at that time, we lost track in close formation of the whole pack of ships. It was so high, for minutes on end, in the troughs of wave. We didn't have to worry, because we knew if one closed in on us, it would crush us flying into a sardine tin, we always say.
And it was at that time you had engine problems?
Well, it was soon after that, but we sailed and picked up the convoy when we left Bermuda. They treated us beautifully there. of course, once we got in there, but they didn't want to give us any fresh water to replenish the because of the scarcity of it. But anyway, we sailed, and that was during the U-boat campaign, which really only learned, it's rather strange, really, because you take it all for granted. You know there are U-boats around and could be planes at any moment. It was only, I think, was it 3 years, maybe four, the television showed you and told you about the packs of probably 30 or more U-boats in packs in the Atlantic at that time. I have the Atlantic Star, which I'm proud of, because that was only 6 months of the war when that was awarded, so I have that, and six others, of course.
So did you set off from New York with a convoy?
No. Right. We picked that up after we were on our own at that time,
yeah.
And then we needed going to Bermuda because of engine trouble, which was a good wheeze anyway. And I say lived it up for about 6 weeks.
What did you do for six weeks?
Well, actually, we were entertained left, right, and centre. And really were. And we had, you know, different societies and things invited. I went to a wonderful one on an island, Bombay, in... one of the islands of Bermuda, taken by boat, and we had a wonderful barbecue picnic all day. Absolutely, all. Yeah, I was the only naval person there with all some very nice young people, including females, of course, but which was rather nice. And we swam and ate and drank, you know, nice drinks, which was very, very friendly and out of this world.
Could you swim before you joined the Navy?
Oh, yes. I always loved swimming, because being near here, I'd swim in anything at any time, which proved a boom, because I had quite a bit. I was renowned for my swimming, even in a six-knot current, and I did help. Well, help. I found some idiot that was rocking his boat deliberately and couldn't swim, and I had to jump over and save him, which was detail. Klopp. Yeah, he did come and thank me and his commanding officer for saving his life. Several episodes like that. Nothing better than a job to do and duty. That's how I looked at it then. I do today, really. Hence that even my near family know nothing about me. I just really want to forget most of it. But I know I've been called many times a miracle survivor, which I have mentioned to you before, and I know I am, and just thank God for it. Nobody else I can think of that in many cases could have helped me. I'm Christian, but not a great church goer, but as Isabel says, there's somebody up there looking after us, isn't there? And I said, yeah, well, who else? And I'm sure that is true, absolutely. Anyway, crossed the Atlantic and into Algiers. Algiers was a mess, it had been bombed a few times. And then from there, all the landings, that's when we started work.
Can you recall when you landed at Algiers?
Hmm?
Can you recall when you landed at Algiers?
Well, I suppose... I suppose it would be the end of February. Yeah, and then, of course, straight away, we were called to land all along the coast. I saw the map, Vibo, Valencia. That was in... I get mixed up with Italy and Sicily, too, because of their quick succession. But I know it was through to Bizerta that we went. I had a bout of dysentery. That was funny enough, because what they did, they took you ashore, they gave you a pill to clear you out, and a pill to buck you up, putting it very candidly. And I remember it was in a deserted hall, all lines of people, 8th Army people, and myself. I'm not aware whether there was any other naval person. But lined up, you saw a sick bay attendant, or whatever they like to call themselves, once a day with a pill and a drink, and you were left all right to stew in it, which grim enough today, but acceptable. At least you're still breathing uncomfortably. Soon after, I was taken back with tremendous temperature into a hospital. And I shall never forget that, because I remember delirious, and I know this sounds strange perhaps, delirious, I fell out of bed, or rolled out of bed, and I remember very well that when I came round, somebody was lifting me, and we were all alone, and it was a man who just had his leg blown off. And he managed in the chopper bed, makeup bed next to me, close. It was helping me back, and it just had the remains of his shattered leg removed and managed to help me back into bed. I didn't know what I was doing. I still remember that. You know, the kind of people you'd like to meet today and say, because what I was lucky enough on, my skipper always waited somewhere, somehow, to get me back on board. To get me back on board where I was lucky, with what we considered to be very close-knit, you know, the crew, very close-knit.
You remember the names that were in the crew with you?
One or two I remember very well, but I don't like to remember them, because a couple of them I remember very well, because in several cases I had to put them under close arrest, and the memories are so poignant and nasty, really, because including two I remember that became eventually cupboards, I discovered, and found them hiding in the heat of the trouble across the Messina Straits. I know the names, I'll never forget them, because they were what we call good boys in harbour. Anyway, all off there, we carried at that time 1/3, we were told, of the rocket shells for the rocket ships, which at that time was new. They turned tank landing craft, were turned into rocket ships and fired in one simultaneously 200 rockets at once, sideways, and they could fire 200 of these explosive rockets, shells, at once, one button press. And we were told we carried 1/3 of the rocket supply in the Mediterranean at that time. And then they said, you know, one shell will blow the lot up, and this was dead cargo, so it cheered us up no end. Because one strap, well, it can shell from a fighter plane, would blow us sky high. And we always said they won't find enough of us to make a sardine can, you know. So anyway, survived that.
So your job on the North African coast, Algiers,
yes,
and
all along.
You were landing troops.
Yes, what we were doing, we collected, generally speaking, sometimes it was the beach we'd been to before, collecting when there was a bridgehead, taking the 8th Army at that time, around and into another, and round and into another. But sometimes, if it was... it's always risky. then we got them directly off a troop ship and took them in. At one time, I might be able to put it on the map, but I think it was Viva Valencia. I hope that's in Africa, but I think it was, because of a landing craft next to us, within 30 feet of us, a Suka, you know, the Suka bomber, came over along the beach. There were only about four of us along there, but the craft next to us had a direct hit on the well deck, as we called it, the forward troop space. But the metal being so thin, the dive bomber being so low, that it went straight through in the soft sand and didn't explode until it was well under the sand. And there was only one killed there. The troops had gone ashore, and only one killed, and that was the person... Only one was killed who was in the wheelhouse through concussion. Only one. And that was the vibration and, you know, the aftermath of implosion afterwards.
When did the shell strike the landing craft? When it had landed?
Landed the troops gone ashore, fortunately. And then, of course, obviously, while the troops landed a bit late, you see, landing craft have landed, called up planes nearest a bit late, really. Troops had gone. About three of them, one after another, along the waterline, you see.
You feel the effect of the blast from there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You'll have to tell me about, just while we're on it, about an explosion. Tell me about your explosives training.
Oh, yes, yes.
That's
well,
interesting.
Oh, yes. Well, of course, that goes back before. That's interesting. I'm glad you've reminded me, because that was part of my training. It was always, would you like, excuse me, always like, would you care to do an explosive?
When were you asked this?
Well, soon after, even before training finished, this was part of the initial training. Like the landing craft, which I've said about when the tank landing craft, Isle of Arran, the first of the tank landing craft, landing, practice landings, on the beaches of Arran. One of the main things, of course, it was all new, even to every one of us, including the skipper. It was all new, because he had to be told how to let the door down, to let the tanks off, there were no tanks. But every crew know their places, it hadn't got a clue. But the most memorable part of this training, only for a couple of days, was the Tutihogis, and they were great big things like this, pastry things, that you could call them Cornish pasties, but big, and they were full of chunky bits of beef and onion and potato, and they were about as big as this for lunch.
About a foot long.
Oh yes, colossal, and they were called Tutihogis. It was supposed to be the proper name, Scottish name. And you don't know it.
I've never heard of it.
Oh, potato hoggies. Potato, yeah, hoggings. More than a meal, actually, but grand. And great big mugs from great big cans of stewed up tea, which was fascinating. And, of course, jolly well needed after going off and coming in, dropping the kedge anchor, coming in, pulling yourself off, all real stuff. But then, of course, the explosive at the same time at the Troon Golf Course was really a scream. You'd like to do a course on explosives, wouldn't you? Well, yes. Anyway, I reported to the office, and I remember this wonderful, old, very old, petty officer. He said, right, let's get the key, and then we'll go walk. Got the key, and off we went. Then I realised that it was onto a golf course at Troon, and scene six was great fun, really, because I've always wanted to ring them and say, I'd tell you a story about your championship golf course. And here we went across, and there were Nissen huts across there, and we went into the first one. Now, I may not have a clue, like my first months of the Navy, never having a clue, and I'd like a lamb to the slaughter, if you like, which is exactly really what it was. Anyway, he goes inside the door straight away, a box on the floor. He opens the top, takes out a big sausage thing, I suppose about 6 inches by 2.5, perhaps 3 inches thick card. He just got his penknife out and I said, this is gelignite. Cuts the, you know, wondering what the dickens, a herd of gelignite, and then twists it like a sausage and breaks it in two, throws a bit back in the box. You can imagine the feeling. Gelignite being thrown back in the box. And then gets his cigarette lighter out. And I thought, oh, well, won't take long. If he wants to go, so do I. That's fair enough. And then lights this with his cigarette lighter, which only sizzled, all new to me, of course. I knew cordite, you know, with the least match, it was just like that. But gelignite, sizzle, sizzle. And he said, well, that's all right. He stumped that out on the ground. It only sizzled anyway, it didn't light. And then tossed that back in the box. And there was me. I'm still alive. Oh, dear. What's he got in store now? He said, yeah, but he said, with this Cortex, white rolls of wire, rolls and all, and he said, well, what do you need? He said, see, you must be 30, 40 yards away, so we'll take about 50 yards of this. And that burns at something like 200 feet a second. He said, but there's one important thing. And then to a steel case, we went, steel cabinet, we went. He said, now, this is the danger part. And takes out a little box, and in it had little tiny cigarettes, the size of a cigarette. All around. Looked like, all right, think of it now, like glass valves. And he said, now, this is a detonator. Put one in my hand, he said, no, you mustn't keep it there more than a few seconds, even the heat might explode. And then he said, this battery, a two-cell battery, ordinary torch battery with a bit on top and a bit down the front, with brass little bits, and he said, right, we'll never keep the two together. You have one, I'll keep the detonators in my pocket. You have the Cortex over there, and I'll hold the gelignite, and we'll find something to test it on and show you. And we walked across the Troon golf course till we came to a strategic placed pile of telegraph poles, which could be used for electric poles in case an air raid had been, the cables of one or the other had been blasted, and they could quickly put posts, new posts up to carry the power or the telephone wires or whatever. And one was at an angle, had been blown from a neat pile, I suppose you could say 15 of them. He said, this will do. One was at an angle from the top to the ground below.
The line flat, the poles on the ground.
What, the pole?
The poles,
yeah. No, all is stacked nicely, except one that it rolled over, and the top was resting on the pole, and the bottom was on the ground. So he said, this will do. First of all, get the gel ignited and put it on the, press it onto the pole, and then wrap the wire around this to fix it on. And he said, and then he said, we'll put the detonator, we'll have the electric wire, fix it to the detonator carefully, and put it in, making sure the wires at the end don't touch. Put it in case a short circuit of any kind, you never know. Put it in, fix that, and then we walk back. And he said, right, you've got the Cortez reservoir in there, the detonator in there, the electric wires fixed to the detonator. Let's walk back. He said, you carry the wire, and I'll carry the detonators, and I'll hold the battery. And as we were walking back, he said, well, no, what do you do? He said, what we have to do is to fix one of the wires, this just ordinary electric wire, one around there, and he said, and then